Good Friday evening. Welcome to the program tonight. My name is Mike Malloy. I used to like that song, but he's got a line in there, "The world stops on Friday." All of a sudden that has scary meaning. We have a Bridget Speaks for you tonight coming up. I don't know, maybe we'll do it at the bottom of this hour. It's a good one. We haven't heard from her in months. I got some emails that I want to share with you because I have a feeling that a lot of people write to this program because they know there's a good chance to get what they have to say out on the air. I don't know how often that happens on other radio programs, but we try our best here. And then I've got something for you, which is the scariest thing that I've read about this BP Gulf catastrophe. I want to share it with you, and then I sent it on to Bruce Enberg, and I got an answer back from him, so I'll share with you his answer. Kay Petrini, our educational affairs correspondent, sent this in. The subject line is a question, social progress. Social progress? Oh, by the way, we're not web streaming tonight. No, we're not video streaming tonight. Hey, Mike, as you know, it is summer vacation, and I'd hope to keep school concerns out of my mind for at least the first couple of weeks. Thanks to the sickening clips you played of Limbaugh on last night's show, no such luck. Now, what she's referring to is the comments that filthy human being made about hungry children. And at the very end, he suggested they learn how to dumpster dive. He said, but, you know, you might have some competition from homeless people. But anyway, Kay writes, my father was an historian who studied the FDR era extensively. He was a voracious reader, and he'd always share things he found particularly interesting or outrageous with me. One night, he called me in a fury. He said, quote, I know that Republicans don't give a damn about the people who suffered during the Great Depression. And I thought I was beyond being shocked by anything they did until today. Evidently, one of the Republican robber barons who opposed FDR's New Deal did so on the grounds that so much restaurant food was being wasted. Why not have the restaurants put their leftovers in huge vats and make those scraps available to the hungry? If my dad were still alive, I would have asked him to remind me of which Republican bastard made that remark, because unlike me, Dad remembered everything. Up to now, I have presented history as a progressive narrative to my students. Sure, I had to grit my teeth at times when that was clearly not true, a progressive narrative, as was the case during 8 years of the Bush crime family. But after hearing Limbaugh's dumpster-diving remarks on the show last night, I'm going to have to reevaluate this whole notion that we really have moved forward as a nation. Because if anything, Limbaugh's comments illustrate that we are back to a gilded age, the time of social Darwinism, robber barons, and, quote, every man for himself, end quote. And a lot of Americans seem to be damn proud of it. Okay. Thomas in Little Rock writes, Mike, I don't know if you heard what the talking pig said on his show a couple of days ago about the oil spill. He said it correlates to one millionth of an ounce of oil in a bathtub of water. In other words, no big deal, nothing to worry about, instead of the possibility of a catastrophe ending life on Earth, typical of this subhuman parasite. Thomas in Little Rock. John in No, wait a minute. I'll get to that in a second. These are about unemployment. The John in Raleigh writes, Mike, a friend of mine tells me she's having trouble with the North Carolina Unemployment Department getting her weekly claim paid. Never happened before to her, but she says in the last month she files a claim and is not paid. She calls and they tell her it is because claims are all hand-keyed into the system, but she will see the claims paid. Days pass and nothing. She calls again. She gets the excuse that the supervisor has to key them, but the supervisor only was in the office for 2 hours, so it will be tomorrow. Nothing happens tomorrow. She calls back and is told that the claims have not been entered because of a backlog. A friend who works for the North Carolina Alcoholic Beverage Control Stores says this is because North Carolina Unemployment Commission is out of money. My guess is there is truth in here somewhere, but I'm guessing also that it is happening across the country. The media have not been talking about this. Meanwhile, the Senate seems to have said not just no, but hell no to extending unemployment benefits. I wonder what is going to happen since millions depend upon unemployment benefits to survive. The so-called liberal blogs are saying nothing about this issue. I'm guessing it's because to criticize Democrats has become a no-no. I can see how groupthink must have worked in Germany in the 30s. We're nowhere near grasping what is actually happening in this country outside the Beltline of Washington, D.C. John and Raleigh. And I have to tell you, it's just been a steady flow of emails of a certain tone. I mean, in the 20-some years I've been in this business, well, we didn't have emails at the beginning, but in the past 10 years when emails really took off as an instrument in talk radio, what I've noticed, an aspect of talk radio, what I've noticed is a a closing off in terms of attitude, closing off of positive thought or hope or the ability to look at the future and say, well, you know, things would get better. And that's pretty frightening to me. And the reason is that probably like a lot of people who listen to this program, I and my family started out pretty low on the food chain. We were lower working class, I guess, if there is such a category. And had a lot of struggles. A lot of struggles when I was a kid. A lot of struggles just getting my parents getting food on the table. And getting government food. That's probably one of the reasons what Limbaugh said the other night was so infuriating to me. Because I can remember my parents bringing home government surplus cheese, government surplus butter and eggs and rice and beans. And, bringing it home in packaging that said U.S. Government Department of Agriculture. This is before food stamps. And I've told those stories on this program before. But a lot of people that had a similar experience or just above that, you know, their parents always worked. Mine didn't. Or if they did, they worked at a lot of low-paid jobs. But people just above me in that when I was a kid in the economic food chain and another step up. Beyond that, who are working poor, came through it. And the reason we came through it is because there was opportunity. There was opportunity for education, for employment, for, moving on up, as the song goes, getting out of a three-story walk-up or a six-story walk-up into maybe a duplex and then maybe into a house. And, you know, and what I'm noticing here is even from people who went through that, who know, as I knew, that things get better. All of a sudden, that sense of things getting better is diminishing. And I think that's the scariest part of all this, is that almost a sense of defeat. I hope it doesn't come to that. I hope we pull out of this. His place in heaven, because he might just die. Losing hope is easy.
For your humble and obedient servant, Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. Back to some of these emails. Dear Mike, this is from Evelyn. I listen to your show each night via KPTK in Seattle, as we have no progressive radio here in Knoxville, Tennessee. I believe in the possibility of a higher power, but can't stand organized religion in any form. It is always used to control and oppress the human race, especially women. I've long known who my enemy is, and were I a religious person, I would have to say they have it all wrong. The beast is the corporation, whose only reason for being is to gobble up all the world's resources and make all people wage slaves. I'm writing you today to ask why we're no longer hearing anything on the radio about unemployment. Today they say it went down, but they also said part of that is due to temporary census jobs. What about those of us who exhausted our benefits and aren't even considered in the equation? Well, the Gulf spill is horrendous. So is a country that allows people who have worked all their lives to lose everything they had because, quote, we have no money, or it will cost too much, end quote. Wait till they start adding up the cost of housing, putting these people in shelters. A country that could spend billions to bail out the idiots that caused this mess, but not the victims, should be ashamed of itself. We have been without income for 4 months now, and we're not alone. Does the government care about that? Does the corporations? Of course not. This country is headed to a very bad place. It's kind of hard to be optimistic. Any ideas on a plan of action? We are already in school retraining. We used to work in manufacturing. But wonder if there really will be a job there when we finish. Anyway, keep up the good work. At least we know we are not the only ones who see the craziness. Evelyn. And Steve was writing to give me an explanation about Blue's phone call from Nepal and why seemed to go through fairly quickly. And then he writes, second, I have to write about Limbaugh's rant about poor kids because I almost cried on the subway this morning listening to his comments. Frankly, I nearly cried just proofreading this email. When I heard him talking about going to the cupboard or opening up the refrigerator, it reminded me of when I grew up. My parents divorced when I was four. I lived mostly with Mom, but both parents, thank God, were very involved, and I lived with both. However, I can remember, though I was too young to understand, that we had little food at times. I remember we couldn't afford a toaster, so my mom had to fry the bread in a small pan in order to, quote, toast it, end quote. When I think about this, and Limbaugh's comments, I nearly cry because it doesn't occur to this filthy piece of human waste that there are people in this country who go to the cupboard and it's bare, who go to the refrigerator and there is no food. To laugh at the poor like that makes me feel every emotion at once, anger, sadness, rage, and disgust. I live in East Harlem in New York City. I see people every day who struggle with the basics of life and who work harder and longer hours than that piece of human waste just to make ends meet. I don't think I ever really believed that Rush truly hated and felt contempt and disgust for the poor. But this tells me I was just wrong. Steve. Yeah, we had that problem, Steve. We didn't have a toaster either. What my mother used to do was we used the kitchen oven for heat. And in the morning, she would put some slices of Wonder Bread. It was Sherlock's Bakery bread. There was a bakery down the street from us. And they sold bread that would be returned by the returned by the delivery man. They used to deliver bread to your house, believe it or not. Bread returned by the delivery man would go on sale the next day for about a third of the price that sold in the stores, which means it sold for about 15 cents a loaf. So we would get that bread. My mom would send us down to the bakery to get that bread. And in the morning, with no toaster, she would just, because she had to have the oven on for heat anyway, she would put the bread in the oven. And this was white bread, you know, the kind that if you mush it between your fingers, it turns into spackling compound. So it would toast up pretty easily. I guess that was toast. I don't know. So I know what you're talking about, Steve. You got to laugh, pal. You got to laugh at this stuff because some of it, not hungry kids by any means, but stuff that we went through as kids, because obviously you survived it and so did I, in a manner of speaking, I guess, right? All right, we have a break here, and we're going to come back, finish up some of these emails. Bottom of the next hour, we will be giving away a one-year podcast subscription to this program, commercial-free download. And we also have a Prairie 2 report and Bridget Speaks. So all in all, just a chock-a-block program. Stick around. It's going to get much worse before it gets better. I'm Mike Malloy.
Helping of truth, it's more Mike Malloy.
25 before the hour. Now, regarding the employment situation, Bruce Prairie 2 writes in the subject line, jobless men keep moving. You're not welcome here. For those of you who don't know, that was a sign that you used to find. Or not you or I. Well, maybe you did. I don't know how old you are. But there is a photographic record, a lot of photographs taken by American photographers, iconic, what became iconic photographs of people in the Depression in the 30s, the Dust Bowl days, the so-called Okies, the breadline, so on and so forth. And I remember seeing that, one of those signs, is outside a small town, I guess in Kansas or Oklahoma or someplace, but it said, jobless men keep moving. You're not welcome here. And that's what Prairie 2 is referencing tonight. He writes, there's a big showdown coming between the Obama administration and the People's Republic of China. China had intimated that they were about to revalue their currency when their premier came to Washington for the nuclear weapons conference. Since then, they have used the Euro crisis to stall any action indefinitely. Secretaries Clinton and Geithner plus Fed Chairman Bernanke have all been to China and have reportedly delivered an ultimatum to that country. Obama has told them that they must announce that they will revalue their currency by the G20 meeting that starts at the end of next week. The word is that China's failure to act will result in an intense pushback from Washington. Their money is undervalued by about 40% by most estimates, and the Congress is chomping at the bit to ramp up tariffs before the election season starts. This is more political than substantive. Just revaluing their currency won't bring the jobs back to the U.S., since the multinational corporations that are now our masters aren't going to do that, no matter what the currency is worth. By the way, gold reached a new high today. On the jobs front, that iconic billboard from the last Republican Great Depression is back in corporate form. That billboard that said, "Jobless men, keep moving, you're not welcome here." Reportedly, three-quarters of corporations and job placement firms have an openly declared policy of not even considering applicants who are not currently employed. And the other 25% of these companies just don't say it out loud. This is as universal as any right-wing talking point, so it isn't just their dark side of the force training they got at MBA school. The largest corporations are enacting this policy in writing. Somebody is pushing this meme with the clear intention of creating a permanent underclass. Since they can't whip the corporate slaves anymore, they're doing the next best thing, a sort of neo-blacklisting. Offend the corporation, and you will be driven out into the wilderness where you and your family will perish. In the old days, if you became disillusioned with the corporate world, you could go into business for yourself or get a middle-class union job. Walmart makes owning a small business impossible, and there are no union jobs anymore. Every day, thousands of people exceed the maximum number of weeks of unemployment, and a third are not even eligible for benefits. The lines at Rush Limbaugh's dumpster are going to get longer and longer. By the way, Hitler's brown shirts were recruited in the soup kitchens. Prairie2.com. Prairie2.com. Dear Mike and Kathy, it was great to talk to you last night about this oil spill mess. This is from Andy in Ripon, Wisconsin, where the Republican Party was born, he said. It was great to talk to you last night about this oil spill mess. This whole situation just makes me sick. I really think that this could be the final blow to Mother Earth and our ecosystem as we know it. I have really never felt so helpless as I do now. My wife and I have two small children, and I can't help feeling that maybe we shouldn't have brought them into the world with the way things are now. Anyway, I'm very glad you and Kathy do what you do to get the truth out and hope you continue to do so. Please keep it up. All the best, Andy in Ripon, Wisconsin. Yeah, I know that feeling. You talk about setting up a conflict inside your own head. You know, you have children. If you have young children right now, and you're conscious, it does set up a real dichotomy about, you know, you love your kids and you're terrified of what's going to happen to them. As you know, I have adult children. I have grandchildren. And I never felt this way about my now adult children when they were growing up. It was, you know, the struggle is what the struggle is. And you're going to do this, you're going to do that. I've got a couple of kids who, adult children who graduated from university, a couple who did not, went on and did other things, developed skills that are just as income generating as, say, a dental hygienist or somebody like that. But as my other children grew up, it was just a given that we would muddle through somehow. I mean, the ones that wanted to go to school, we would get them in school. We'd pay the tuition, pay the books, do whatever. The ones that did not want to go to school, wanted to take a career track and do something else, we'd support that. And did it. And it was just, you know, like I said, sometimes it was a real struggle. Sometimes it was, you know, do I pay Wendy's tuition this quarter, or do I, put a roof on the house. Well, there was no question. Pay Wendy's tuition. So if you have small children now, those kinds of assurances, self-assurances, just don't apply anymore, do they? It gets scary. There's not a night that we put Molly to bed before we do this program that I don't have a brief thought, fleeting but there nonetheless, about her future and people her age all over the planet. Not just Molly, although Molly is, obviously she gets my focus, like your child or your niece, your nephew, your grandkid get your focus. But it's difficult to do, and I know I'm right there with new parents. Even though I have grown children, I also have an almost 6-year-old. So it's scary. It is very scary. You don't know exactly what to do, or what to tell your kids, how to prepare them for stuff. I guess the best thing is to keep them as innocent as you can for as long as you can. I mean, people in my cohort grew up in, the baby boomers, we grew up under the threat of instant nuclear annihilation. And I can remember being scared, duck and cover, but it was just in the background. We went ahead and just behaved as children. Played sandlot baseball. Did all those things you do when you're a kid. But, so the hope is, I guess, that, the kids growing up now, they're aware of this catastrophe, but it's kind of in the background. The difference, of course, is that nuclear annihilation, of course, is still there. Never did go away. Now we have ecological destruction and breakdown. And we also have the horrible fact of kids growing up in families where nobody can find any work. I mean, the truth is, even though we were at times desperately poor when I was a kid, there were 4 of us kids and we could always go make money. Oh, my God. Mowing lawns, shoveling snow, raking leaves, running errands, and we did. Newspaper outs, selling papers on the corner in the morning. We did. My mother worked as a waitress. My old man, when he got kind of blacklisted because of certain points of view that he had, he was a time cost analyst and worked on huge construction projects and ran into a brick wall when he was in his mid-40s. So, but we still muddled through, and I think a lot of families in the boomer generation can tell the same story. Now that we are, we're on that leading edge now of the retirees. All of a sudden we have become our own grandparents. Whoops, how did that happen? Ow! But there was always still, through the possibility of nuclear annihilation and yada, yada, yada. There was still, no, that's not going to happen. As we've said on this program before, avoidance and denial are great mechanisms to muddle through. They really are. And sometimes they work. I just wonder if they still work. You know what I'm saying?
I said something wrong. Yesterday, all my troubles seem so far away. Now it looks as though they're here to stay. Oh, I believe in yesterday. Suddenly, there's a shadow hanging over me. I'm not half the man I used to be.
Thank you.
ready to make nice, it's Mike Malloy.
Better speak to the powers that be today. Hey Joe, where you go?
It is 10 before the hour. After the break at the top of the hour, I want to get to this very scary, scary, scary thing that I was sent today. I think Dave in Florida sent it to me. Anyway, back to some of the emails. Richard, listening in Southern California, writes, Mike, I'm an avid listener to your show and a repeat podcast subscriber. Hearing the podcast today late on my way to work is the only time I could hear your show, living on the West Coast and spending what little time I have with my wife and kids after a long day working at one of those fascist corporations in order to provide for my family. Why I feel compelled to write is that over the past several weeks, I've heard story after story recounting how this oil disaster is only getting worse. What really hit home for me was the story that the pipe under the seafloor is deteriorating, and at its current rate, the entire system will eventually collapse on itself, making any hope of stopping this gusher an impossibility. I'm just heartbroken to hear this doomsday scenario, Mike. Bad as it is now, this eventuality, if it progresses to fruition, will complete the destruction of the southern ecosystem if it hasn't already gone past the point of no return. The other heartbreaking thing to see and hear is that the United States is now a wholly owned subsidiary of the multinational corporations. Damn Rush Limbaugh and Beck and Hannity and Bachman and the rest of the right-wing crazies for spewing their hatred. They're leading those who blindly listen and follow their words to their own destruction and demise. This country has such incredible potential to be great. But the problems now are so monumental, I personally feel that any hope the tide will change, like the oil disaster, is past the point of no return and will soon collapse on itself. Only this time will not spare any southern state, but will destroy the entire country. When the lights go out, Mike, I will be there with you. And the pig man, Rush. Keep up the fight, Mike. Regards, Richard, listening in Southern California. You know, I agree with Richard on something about the the potential in this country is still there. We've developed this learned helplessness that because all the corporations have moved out and the governments, state governments are collapsing. They literally are collapsing. Ecological system that is on which we're so dependent is being brutalized by these corporations. It's not government that does this stuff. This is why the teabaggers make me want to vomit blood. It's because it's not government who does this stuff. Government itself, the corrupted government that has come to into existence in the past 35 or 40 years, yes. But government itself doesn't do this stuff. It is the corporations, the capitalist system that does this and does it repeatedly. That's why I do not and cannot understand the mindset of these teabaggers or conservatives in general, any conservative who like this freakish toad, Joe Barton, who sat in that hearing the other day and apologized to BP, for Christ's sake, and called an attempt by Obama to get this filthy corporation to put some money aside for people on the Gulf Coast, referred to that as a shakedown. I mean, Joe Barton really and truly should be taken off someplace. And he said he didn't want to live in a country that does that. Joe, you're absolutely right. I don't want to breathe the same air you do, that you scum sucker. He ought to be taken to an island someplace and just set loose. Or put him in a rowboat like somebody suggested the other night. Give him enough food for a week and put him out in the middle of this oil slick. And if Joe survives, he survives. If he doesn't, the world will be a better place. You know what I'm saying? Oh, my God. But we don't have to keep doing this, do we? I mean, where is it written, and in what document or what filthy religious tract is it written that we can't say enough and reorganize ourselves? We don't have to have violent revolution. That's what the crazies are talking about. That's what these morons, these beer-gutted sons of bitches who run around in the woods with their rifles and their scare talk, and the ones say, Obama's from Kenya. Don't listen to that garbage. I mean, it is garbage. We don't have to continue to do this. We really don't. And it doesn't take massive demonstrations. All it takes, I shouldn't say all it takes, because this would be the most difficult thing we've ever done. What it takes is an ability to start, I hate the word networking, linking up would be better, making contact with other people. Forming communities. There are an awful lot of garden co-ops in the suburban and exurban Atlanta area where people, black and white, gay and straight. I mean, everybody's hip to this now. This is not an elitist thing. The garden cooperatives, where there will be a lot someplace, open space. In a neighborhood or just outside of a neighborhood, and somebody will do a quick check with the county to find out who owns it. And if the county owns it, they just get a quick permit to grow some garden stuff on it or what have you. Or if they can find the owner, they contact that person. But the next thing you know, people are growing food. We have probably three friends who live inside the city who have recently started raising chickens. Right, Kathy? You know, Molly went to one of these kids' houses the other day for to play with a couple of the girls that Molly went to preschool or kindergarten with. And she came back and she said, Daddy, I got to gather the eggs. These are people that live in neighborhoods and cities. I mean, this is not out in the country. This is in, you know, when are we going to get some chickens? Soon. It is 7 past the hour. This is the Molloy program. Now, what I want to share with you is that, I don't know if you're familiar with the website. I never heard of it till today, helium.com. Helium, as in the gas, helium.com. And I took a look at their whole website. It looks like a pretty good website. How the ultimate BP Gulf disaster could kill millions is written by Terrence Aim. Disturbing evidence is mounting that something frightening is happening deep under the waters of the Gulf of Mexico, something far worse than the BP oil gusher. Warnings were raised as long as a year before the Deepwater Horizon disaster that the area of seabed chosen by the BP geologists might be unstable or worse, inherently dangerous. What makes the location that Transocean chose potentially far riskier than other potential oil deposits located at other regions of the Gulf? It can be summed up with two words, methane gas. The same methane that makes coal mining operations hazardous and leads to horrendous mining accidents deep under the earth also can present a high level of danger to certain oil exploration ventures. The location of the Deepwater Horizon oil rig was criticized more than 12 months ago. Some geologists rang the warning bell that the Deepwater Horizon exploratory rig might have been erected directly over a huge underground reservoir of methane. Documents from several years ago indicate that the subterranean geological formation may contain the presence of a huge methane deposit. None other than the engineer who helped lead the team to snuff the Gulf oil fire set by Saddam Hussein, the Persian Gulf fire set by Saddam Hussein to slow the advance of American troops, has stated that a huge underground lake of methane gas compressed by a pressure of 100,000 pounds per square inch could be released by BP's drilling effort to obtain the oil deposit. Current engineering technology cannot contain gas that is pressurized to 100,000 pounds per square inch. By some geologists' estimates, the methane could be a massive 15 to 20 mile toxic and explosive bubble trapped for eons under the Gulf seafloor. In their opinion, the explosive destruction of the Deepwater Horizon wellhead was an accident just waiting to happen. Yet the disaster that followed the loss of the rig pales by comparison to the apocalyptic disaster that may come. According to worried geologists, the first signs that the methane may burst its way through the bottom of the ocean would be fissures or cracks appearing on the ocean floor near the damaged wellhead. Evidence of fissures opening up on the seabed have been captured by the robotic submersibles working to repair and contain the ruptured well. Smaller independent plumes have also appeared outside the nearby radius of the borehole itself. According to some geological experts, BP's operation set into motion a series of events that may be irreversible. Step by step, the drilling team committed one error after another. Congressman Henry Waxman and Bart Stupak, in a letter to BP CEO Tony Hayward, identified five missteps made by BP during the period culminating with the explosion. Waxman, chair of the Congressional Energy Panel, and Stupak, the head of the Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations, said, quote, "The common feature of these five decisions is that they posed a trade-off between cost and well safety," end quote. The two representatives also stated in the 14-page letter to Hayward that, quote, "Time after time, it appears that BP made decisions that increased the risk of a blowout to save the company time or expense," end quote. Called by some insiders investigating the disaster a perfect storm of catastrophe, the wellhead blew on the seafloor, catapulting a stream of mud, oil, and gas upwards at the speed of sound. In describing the events that transpired in a matter of seconds, they note that immediately following the rupture, the borehole's pipe casing blew away, exposing a straight line 8 miles deep for the pressurized gas to escape. The result was cavitation, an irregular pressure variance sometimes experienced by deep diving vessels such as nuclear subs. This cavitation created a supersonic bubble of explosive methane gas that resulted in a supersonic explosion, killing 11 men and completely annihilating the drilling platform. But the emerging evidence of fissures, the quiet fear now, is the methane bubble rupturing the seabed and exploding into the Gulf waters. If the bubble escapes, every ship, drilling rig, and structure within the region of the bubble will instantaneously sink. All the workers, engineers, Coast Guard personnel, and marine biologists measuring the oil plume's advance will instantly perish. As horrible as that is, what would follow is an event so potentially horrific that it equals in its fury the Indonesian tsunami that killed more than 600,000 or the destruction of Pompeii by Mount Vesuvius. The ultimate Gulf disaster, however, would make even those historic horrors pale by comparison. If the huge methane bubble breaches the seabed, It will erupt with an explosive fury similar to that experienced during the eruption of Mount St. Helens in the Pacific Northwest. A gas gusher will surge upward through miles of ancient sedimentary rock, layer after layer, past the oil reservoir. It will explode upwards, propelled by 50 tons per square inch, burst through the cracks and fissures of the compromised seafloor, and rupture miles of ocean bottom with one titanic explosion. The burgeoning methane gas cloud will surface, killing everything it touches, and set off a supersonic tsunami, with the waves traveling somewhere between 400 to 600 miles per hour. While the entire Gulf coastline is vulnerable, the state most exposed to the fury of a supersonic wave towering 100 feet or more is Florida. The Sunshine State only averages about 6 inches above sea level. A supersonic tsunami would literally sweep away everything from Miami to the Panhandle in a matter of minutes. Loss of human life would be virtually instantaneous and measured in the millions. Of course, the states of Texas, Louisiana, Mississippi, Alabama, and southern regions of Georgia, a state with no Gulf coastline, would also experience tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of casualties. Loss of property is virtually incalculable, and the days of the U.S. position of the world superpower would be literally gone in a flash of detonating methane. Now that's some scary stuff. The only thing I ever knew about methane in the past 4 or 5 years is that it contributes to global warming by, as compared to carbon dioxide, by a factor of about 10, 30, 40, 50. In other words, it's a very destructive gas. Now, I have an answer to that. I sent that off to Bruce Enberg, who sent me an answer. Not quite as long, but I'll share it with you when we come back after this break, and we'll see what Bruce has to say. I guess by default, I get a lot of very good information from scores of people who contribute to this show with information and links and so on and so forth. But what I've found is I've got these two listeners who's always seem to be able to answer whatever question I send to them, Bruce and Michael. Now, I'm not saying they're right. I'm just saying that they come back fairly quickly with what reads like scientific or carefully thought out responses. I write, you know, I forward these emails to them, usually drenched in panic, and I usually get back a fairly calm, rational response. And the one from Bruce I'll share with you as soon as we come back. Stay with us. Another dollar, another wall, another towel.
Let Mike Malloy do it for you.
21 past the hour. All right. Bruce's response to what I just shared with you, he writes, there is 7 times the methane that they usually get from an oil well coming from the deep water horizon. But end of the world? I doubt it. Normally, they just burn the methane because there isn't enough in an oil well to make it worth capturing. The robotic view of seafloor cracks that Fire Dog Lake is circulating are not cracks. If you watch the entire screen and not just the rock in the middle where the so-called bubbles of oil appear, you will see the arm of the robot in the lower left nudge the rock, and then the bubbles appear. If it were a rock, the robot wouldn't have any effect. The rock appears to be wreckage from the drill rig sinking, and the bubbles are just mud or ash from the fire. The oil strata is 18,000 feet below the seafloor, and there is not going to be that much rock displaced unless Godzilla is crawling up the hole. The relief wells are within a few feet horizontally of the well as of today. They still need to drill down 3,000 feet at this angle of attack to intersect the well bore. Once they do meet, the pressure will drop and capping can begin. There was no supersonic cavitation bubble. This guy is just stringing scary words together. There was an explosion because the blowout preventer wasn't working. It was no worse than when this has happened before. Blowouts in shallow water have been known to swallow the entire rig, as the huge volume of gas in the water makes the water so thin, quote, quote, that it won't provide enough buoyancy to float a boat or even a man in a life jacket. Well, I'm glad to hear it. Okay. No worries. Yeah. I wish I had the, obviously, Bruce Enberg, Prairie 2, is very cool. He is medium cool. And that's a good thing. Boy, I wish I could do that. I wish I could. I work in a radio is a hot medium. Yeah, radio is a hot medium. Film is a cool medium. Television is a cool medium. Bruce, who writes, works in a cool medium. Do you understand these terms? I think they're McLuhan-esque. But Bruce has a coolness. I think Michael has it. A lot of you do. Kate in the desert does. Karen does. I think I could go on and on. I kind of lost that. I find that I spend an awful lot of time these days trying not to be reactive. You know, I keep thinking, reactive is the wrong word. Proactive is the right word. Come on, come on, come on. Proactive. Not reactive. And, yeah, okay. Sure. Let's everybody be proactive. Okay. I'm ready to go. I got my shovel. I got my tomato plant steaks. Come on. Yeah. Off we go. Would that it were that simple. Maybe it is that simple. Maybe it is. But I look around at our leadership. I'm talking about our political leadership. I don't know what goes on behind the scenes. Neither do you. We can all speculate. My speculation is that the political leadership in this country is absolutely wholly owned by corporate America. I don't see any wiggle room at all between what corporate America wants and what they get from our political class. This has happened very slowly and insidiously, but it but it has happened. So I'm not sure what's going on behind the scenes, but I read something today that said Barack Obama is just overwhelmed. It doesn't make any difference who's in charge. They would be overwhelmed at this point. And the failure of the political class to have put a firewall between our system and corporate America, that's the first major failure. The destructive, voracious appetite that knows no boundaries of capitalism. It will eat everything in its path and continue to be ravenously hungry. And it's never satisfied until the whole planet just collapses into a burning ember You know, capitalism, even at that point, won't be satisfied. I'm sure there's some kind of a program that's out there on Voyager 1 or Voyager 2 as it leaves the solar system that will activate if it lands on a planet or any kind of a heavenly body that's amenable to life and immediately start buying and selling stuff, you know? We'll be right back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Out of nowhere, but he ain't what he seems. You'll see him in your head on the TV screen. Hey, buddy, I'm wanting you to turn it on.
Primal Scream You Suppress, Embrace Your Inner Liberal Warrior, with Mike Malloy.
It is 25 before the hour. Coming up after the next break, which will be in just about 15 minutes, we're going to do podcast trivia. So if you'd like to get online now, the number is 877-996-2556. And last night, we ran out of time. We were talking with Blue, who called in from Nepal, told him to call back, and guess what? Here he is. Hey, Blue.
Hey, Mike. I've got a confession to make. I lied to Kath, actually. We're not in Namche today at all.
No?
No. In point of fact, at this very moment, as we speak, we're passing through the Van Allen radiation belt in my personal spacecraft.
I knew that was going to happen.
We're looking for a Burger King or perhaps a BP station so we can use the loo. Perhaps we'll just go inside the office and use that for a loo.
And
as you can hear, the telephone is functioning remarkably well out here as well.
It is. It is indeed.
This trip is being commissioned by the Australian Wine Council.
Yeah.
And they're very keen on establishing once and for all whether the moon is in fact made of green cheese,
which would assist in the production of what, a nice Cabernet?
Well, exactly. They want to know, you know, what sort of Australian wine would go best with it.
I see. I like the Greg Norman vineyard wines. Those are good.
Well, you know, they thought I was uniquely qualified for this assignment, and so I'm gonna do my best.
All right.
But in point of fact, what happened is after we rang off yesterday,
mm-hmm.
We waited an hour or so, and we started off walking on the road. It used to be a trail. It's more of a road these days.
Mm-hmm.
And we got about 15 minutes from the hotel where we were staying in Namche, and I stepped off the road to look at this small, fuzzy, marmot-like creature that was sitting there in the tall grass.
Yeah.
And I stepped in a hole that this thing had dug and sprained my ankle. In fact, I thought I'd broken it. It was tremendously painful.
I'll bet.
And so rather ignominiously ended up going back, leaning on the shoulders of these two fantastic Nepali blokes, Nima and Pasang, who they're actually Sherpas. They were going to go up there with us. We didn't need them for the Sherpa thing, of course, on this walk. But I'd been introduced to them by a Nepali who lives in Melbourne.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm sitting on the veranda here with some fantastic Nepali rum, which is wonderful stuff, by the way. It's the next best thing to Australian Shiraz. So I've got my foot up on the sofa here.
Uh-huh.
And what I really wanted to call about, hang on one second.
Sure.
Yeah, all right.
Yeah, okay.
what I really wanted to call about last night was, you know, I'm as angry, I think, as anybody on the Gulf Coast. It doesn't affect me as directly, but I'm as angry about it. And I'm as angry about what we're hearing from the administration and from these drongos like Tony Hayward and Obama.
Mm-hmm.
And what seems to be missed here, and you know, as I said, we monitor your media quite a bit. What seems to be missed, I don't hear anyone talking about the fact there are solutions, there are ways to stop this leak. And let me repeat that, there are ways to stop this leak. And they don't involve blowing the ocean up with nuclear bombs and all the rest of it.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the Dutch engineers, for example, have been talking about the fact that, you know, for years they've been using these shaped caissons, these enormous concrete caissons, which can be made in any shape and size. And they've got the vessels that can haul them out there, and they have the technology to lower them down and put them on top of that thing and stop it. But that's not what they want to do. And the other thing that's being missed is no one's talking about the fact that what BP is telling Obama and the rest of them is, look, keep your nose out of it. We want to save the well. We want to make this a producing well, and we don't want to set a precedent for destroying a well. But there are ways to fix this thing, and they could have done it weeks ago. They could have done it within 2 weeks. And nobody's talking about that, at least not that I can hear.
Well, I think there is chatter about it, but certainly not in what is considered corporate or mainstream media in this country. There's talk about this. As a matter of fact, I thought I heard a report tonight on one of the broadcast news programs that BP has, in fact, now asked for assistance from several engineering firms in Holland and possibly a Norwegian firm who that have the expertise to do probably exactly what you're talking about.
My point is they should have been told immediately from the start this
oh,
is what
sure.
you're going to do. And, you know, the Dutch have been moving these 8,000-ton concrete caissons around for decades.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's the way they've kept the country above water. And the technology, the vessels, the means to transport these things, they all exist. You don't have to fabricate them. They exist right now.
Right.
And people all over the world are talking about this except in the United States. I mean, as far as I can tell.
Mm-hmm.
And they should have been, the whole thing should have been nationalized from the beginning. Obama should have taken his thumbs out of his rectum and said right from the start, you know, we're going to take over, we're going to do this, and you're drafted to help. We're going to use your gear, your money, your technology. We're going to bring in outside experts. I'm going to stop this bloody leak.
Absolutely. And I think there's a lot of political pushback in this country now along those lines. Of course, the pushback, though, is coming from people who are convinced that Barack Obama's not a citizen of the United States to begin with. So the pushback is coming from the crazy people in the United States, which is about half of us, believe it or not, and possibly more. But you're absolutely right. And, you know, it has, like I said, it has been talked about, just not on a level where it could have been done. Obama, I think it's very clear to those of us who reluctantly, but nonetheless voted for him, that Obama is like every other president we've had for a number of years here. He is a wholly owned subsidiary of corporate America. And for the foreseeable future, as a matter of fact, beyond the foreseeable future, probably as long as there's the United States, we have lost our political system. It is now a corporate system until the people in the United States decide that they've had enough. But as you know, power does not relinquish itself.
No, it doesn't.
Right.
No, it doesn't.
Something has to be changed. It doesn't necessarily have to be violence. It can be non-cooperation with the system, which we've been talking about in this program for 5 years. But this is the United States. We don't do that sort of thing here because we have learned to truly believe that we are incapable of resisting. We've learned to believe that we are helpless. We have learned to believe that someone needs to tell us what to do. Somebody has to find us a job. Somebody has to solve the problems. And this is the...
Well, if you look at what's been happening in Latin America lately, I mean, you've got Evo Morales in Bolivia, and you've got Lula in Brazil. You've got Michelle Bachelet in Chile.
Mm-hmm.
And these people took a page out of Che Guevara's book, and they said, look, one way or the other, we're going to change this. And the first thing we've got to divorce ourselves from, or the first thing we've got to do is to divorce ourselves from the United States and from multinational corporations. And so there's more exciting things going on there than I think, you know, anywhere else in the world.
Mm-hmm.
But what they said is, look, we know what the problem is. It's domination by America, cultural, economic, political domination by America. and by these multinational corporations, and we're going to stop it. And they're making good progress in that respect. I mean, I go to these places, some of them anyway. I go to Chile not infrequently.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I talk to people. I'm in a fortunate position. I can go where I want, pretty much when I want to go there. I mean, even when I'm not working. And I have a chance to talk to people. And there's a lot of anger and ferment out there, Mike. I don't know whether you know this.
Oh, yeah.
about what's going on in your country right now.
Absolutely, absolutely. And I'm afraid what's going to happen is there is going to be a bit of piling on if the United States starts to, if the collapse of our economy, which is well underway, if it continues, the collapse of our political system, which is well underway, if it continues, the United States, since the Spanish-American War, has built up such a horrific, hideous reputation globally as being probably the largest exporter of terrorism in the history of the human race. And I think there's going to be an awful lot of schadenfreude if the United States starts to go down. On any level, if the United States starts to implode, I think there's going to be a celebration.
Well, look, there's still one out for you and your family.
Yeah.
I'm still working on your honorary Queensland citizenship. I haven't given up on that yet.
Well, good. I'm glad to hear it. All right, Blue. Be careful. I hope your ankle gets better and stay in touch. We're about out of time in this segment.
Good day, Mike.
Thanks for checking in. Take care. We are kind of screwed, aren't we? And I don't think there's a bit of doubt. Well, I think one of the reasons the Iranians are just giving us a middle finger regarding our assistance, that they stopped their nuclear program, but of course nobody else has to stop theirs. I think part of the reason, aside from our unqualified support for Israel, is the fact that, you know, 50 years ago, over 50 years ago, we overthrew their government and put in somebody friendly to, surprise, surprise, BP.
Life is funny, skies are sunny, bees made honey.
Set aside all the madness, all the disasters, all the really ugly stuff. It's time once again for podcast trivia on the Molloy Program, where you can win a one-year subscription to the Molloy Show. Podcast downloads commercial-free. All you have to do is come up with the right answer to our multiple-choice question, and you're a winner. Hey, you're a winner. All right, here we go. Who do we, who's the lucky first contestant? Why, it's Terry in Baltimore, Maryland, listening on XM. Hey, Terry.
Hey, Mike.
All right. Are you ready to play? You're not nervous, are you? Hands sweaty?
No.
And you're not? Your throat dry?
No.
Oh, everything's... Your knees aren't shaking?
No.
Oh, okay. All right. Here we go. Here is your question. The Deepwater Horizon explosion is the worst oil disaster in U.S. history, but there is a nation where the estimated volume of oil that has thus far gushed into the Gulf of Mexico spills into its coastal waters every year. That country is A, Venezuela, B, Ukraine, C, India, D, Nigeria.
Nigeria.
You're absolutely right. I have mentioned this on the air, but I've been doing some reading, just research. Oh my God, Nigeria, the most affected region in Nigeria is the Niger Delta. And environmentalists believe it's the most polluted ecosystem in the world. Shell, Royal Dutch Shell alone, according to the Associated Press, spilled 4.5 million gallons of oil into the Niger Delta in 2009. So it just goes on and on. There's a documentary out about this, if you get a chance to see it. I'm not sure what the title is, but it shows the absolute lack of, the lack of concern is almost criminal. The government of Nigeria and these international oil companies have conspired because it's all built based on graft and corruption and deceit and lies, and the people can just choke to death. They don't care. Life expectancy has gone down in the past two decades. It's horrifying. When I hear Tony Hayward sitting in the hearing room, and I watch his demeanor and I watch his boredom. Like he said, we have hundreds of wells around the world. Yes, you do, Tony. And every one of them is destroying whatever it comes in contact with. It's just bizarre, Terry. You are still there, right?
I'm still here.
I'm sorry. I just went nuts there. All right. Hold on, Terry. Thanks a lot. I'm going to put you on hold. Kathy will get the pertinent information, okay?
Thanks, Mike.
Oh, you bet. Bruce writes, remember it was Dick Cheney who was the head of Halliburton and the Harvard MBA George Bush, the two of them saying we needed people who could run government like a business. Of course, it wasn't in the corporate media that Halliburton was pocket change away from bankruptcy and that Bush had never had a business that didn't need to be bailed out by the Saudis, well, except his baseball team, which was supported by a special tax from the citizens that raised $60 million that went right into his pocket. Well, only $50 million went into his pocket. He lost the other $10 million. Cheney took millions of worthless shares of stock in Halliburton as a bonus when he left. Of course, the Iraq War turned that around, making him a billionaire. And true to the word, the Republicans ran the government just like BP. Those Republicans are still fully entrenched in the government, ignoring, circumventing, and contradicting Obama's policies at every turn. That is the real Godzilla that is advancing on the country to destroy us. Yeah, you know, again, it's very easy for me, and I've done it, to just go ahead and put out there my opinion or whatever it is that Barack Obama is nothing more than another corporate shill. And I hate that. Every time I say it, I hate it because I understand, on one level what he's up against. Just like Bruce just pointed out, you know, he's working with a government, and a corporate class that absolutely wants him to fail. There are people in the Republican leadership that want him dead. That actually want him shot. There are commentators in corporate media that do everything they can short of coming out and advocating open season on Barack Obama and his family. You know who they are. They're Glenn Beck and Michael Savage and Limbaugh and Hannity and the rest of these vile bastards. And, you know, every time I really get into criticize Obama mode, there's just something in me that stops me and says, no, wait a second. Do you really think there's no difference between Barack Obama and George W. Bush? Do you really think there's no difference between Barack Obama and Dick Cheney? Do you really think that, Malloy? And, you know, when the lights are out and it's 2 o'clock in the morning, I can lay there and think, no, I don't really think that. You know, what I really do think is that there is difference. Now, I know. All my friends on the left, don't send that email you're composing in your mind right now, because I usually snap back to some kind of political reality that Barack Obama is operating like his predecessors and like those subsequent to his presidency are going to act. And that is, you know, whatever corporate America wants, corporate America gets, until it finally gets to the point where decisions are made by a corporate council, not unlike Mussolini's Italy. So, still, I the other night when he gave that dead speech, somebody pointed out his hands flapping all over the place. He was very defensive. He was begging for some kind of solace or a place to hide. Someone else said that the coded message. When he was talking about pray, he mentioned pray or faith or whatever about 11 times. It's almost like what he was saying, there is no solution to this. So if you're a believing person, pray. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. It is just about 7 past the hour. This is the Malloy program. Coming to your calls here in a moment. Susan in Squim, Washington writes, Mike, yes, I agree that there's no way that Obama is the same or as bad as the Bush-Cheney crime family. We're at all cut from the same cloth. And yes, I also agree with you that he seems as though he is a good man who genuinely wants to do his best in the job. But I ask you, if the end result of his presidency puts us in the same trash can that Bush pulled out of Cheney's spider hole, does it matter? Good intentions are all very nice, but they're not enough. We need a leader who really doesn't think that compromising with corporations is a good idea. We need someone who, like FDR, will get the robber barons pissed off and will say, I welcome your anger. Obama needs to stop talking about kicking ass and actually start kicking it. But, yeah, I think that's a good assessment. Bill writes, Mike, we should all acknowledge that there is a major criticism of our president coming from two camps. Those who think he's a communist, a socialist, a Nazi, and don't just want him out of office, they want him dead. And then there are those of us who just want him to do better. There's a distinction there, and we should continue to push him to do the right thing. Bill in North Carolina. And this is kind of interesting. We were talking about the other night, we were talking about the Joshua tree. And I said, isn't that something that is extremely long-lived? It's something that lives for thousands of years. Tom, who lives in Joshua tree, writes, Mike, creosote is the desert plant that lives 10 to 14,000 years. In the desert heat, it is the root structure that endures and grows in ever-increasing subterranean colonies, sending out an oily leaf above ground that, when boiled, makes good medicine for just about everything that ails you. Yesterday, the electric company, the Edison man, came by to read the meter. Usually he takes the paved road to my cabin, but to save a minute or more from his route, he decided to cut across virgin desert. In doing so, he ran over several cacti, a few flowering shrubs, and mowed down about 5 or 6 creosote bushes, crushing them, breaking their branches, and smothering them in tire treads and sand. I called Edison and made a complaint. I asked the customer relations lady to please educate the drivers to be more respectful of life, because now I must look at dead desert plants for the next year or more just to make himself a couple of dollars. She said, sorry, our driver did that to your house and flowers. I said, no, he did it to the desert where we all live. She said, huh? Where? What? It's our desert, I said. Our land, our lives. Again, I got, huh? Like you mean what? It is a mental disease, Mike, of people that have no idea where they came from, where they are, or where they are going. They're only here to grab, get, and destroy. It wouldn't be so bad if there were only a few of them, but they outnumber us at least 1,000,000 to 1, and they've all got a vote. Tom in Joshua Tree, California. Joe is in Van Nuys, California. Hello, Joe.
Hey, Mike. Long time, sometime.
Okay.
So, yeah, I sent you an email yesterday, and I'm typing real quick, and then I had to hit the spell check, you know, and had to hurry up to go see the game out here because, you know, it's like the quarter, and I've already missed it, you know?
Sure, absolutely.
And I did a just one word thing, just, you know, and it kind of messed the whole email up, and I thought, oh, my God, he's going to read this email and think I'm an idiot.
Yeah?
So, yeah, it was physics and fascists. So I wrote physics, and somehow I guess I was typing, and my big fingers hit the wrong thing. I'm not a really fast typer. So then I hit the spell check, and it somehow changed the physics into fascist. So it was social physics and turned into social fascists. People get aware, and I write this long, compose this long thing, you know, and I ruin the whole thing. I just realized it because, you know, after the game, I got up and looked back at the computer to see if, you know, there's anything, you know, and I was listening to you while watching the game, and by the way, Limba made my ears bleed and my nose bleed.
I hear you.
It's like my brain wants to leak out when he's talking.
Oh, I know. Well, you know, the way to avoid that, of course.
Listen to him.
Yeah, resend the email to me.
Resend the email and then do fix this, the typing thing, of course.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to make sure that, you know, you wouldn't, like, read it out and think, you know, it's an idiot or something. And
I may not
kind of idiot.
I may not have gotten to it. Again, you know, when I went to bed last night, I'd whittled the email file down to about 300, and by this afternoon it's over 700 again, and a lot of it's spam junk crap. But somewhere in the literally hundreds that come from the listeners, yours is in there, I'm sure. But resend it.
I will. Okay. I will. And I called you a couple of times before during that healthcare thing.
You know,
out there with the Move On people trying to raise the awareness, you know, so. Basically, that's basically what I wanted to get to prepare people. You know, you have 50,000 more people covered during this kind of crisis.
Mm-hmm.
All right, because we need health care. We're going to need it in the next uncountable amount of years.
That's true.
That's just one of many things. Probably nothing I put in the email thing that, you know.
Well, I'll look forward to it.
All right, I'm going to resend it to you, and I'm going to fix that little typo thing.
Great. Thanks, Joe.
All right,
take care. We have Bridget Speaks coming after the last bottom of the hour break here in a few minutes, so stick around for that. Mark is in San Francisco listening on Green 960. Hello, Mark.
Good evening, Mike.
Hi.
I just wanted to bring up the fact that 30 years ago when Reagan fired the Patco workers, labor really never responded to that, and the ideology that he installed is what's really destroying this country to this day. Greed is good, you know, corporations before people.
Right.
The whole ideology is what we're fighting right now, and I don't know if this Labor Day, maybe the AFL-CIO, or maybe they could put something together to denounce Reagan's ideology and.
But yeah, they probably could, Mark. But what would be the good? What would be the point? You're absolutely right. The unions did not resist to the point that they should have when the professional air traffic controllers were fired by Reagan for having the temerity to make some demands. And organized labor, as weak as it was in 1980, now would look back at 1980 as a time of strength, and they didn't do anything. And one of the reasons they didn't do anything is because there were so many working class, white, mostly male Americans who decided they were Reagan Democrats. I don't know why. Maybe they thought he was cute. Maybe they had seen too many of his Western movies. I don't know why. But labor did not respond to it. And the labor movement was in its death throes 30 years ago. Now it's on life support, and I think we all know that.
That's why I was thinking maybe this Labor Day. We go every Labor Day. We celebrate it as a holiday, but it really doesn't really have the full meaning it should have. And organized labor has brought so many good things to this country, and Republicans and their ideology is to destroy it. And I think now, you know, it's on its deathbed, but now is the time to bring up the fact that what the Republican ideology has done to this country, mm-hmm. and before we vote in November, is to inform people of what you're voting against. You're voting against an ideology that's destroyed this country, and the Republicans continue to want to push it down our throats.
Well, that's a good point. You're absolutely right, Mark. And I hope that the labor movement can remind people, in much the same way our 4th of July celebrations remind people that at one time we fought for independence from Britain. The labor movement can always remind people that at one time there was something in this country called organized labor and the union movement. Mark, I got to leave it there. Thanks, sir.
I like it that way. I don't hear liberals talking to me. I don't see things their way. Yeah, I'm on the right side.
You're listening to Resistance Radio with Mike Malloy.
It is 21 past the hour. Back to your calls. Warren is in Revere, Massachusetts. Hey, Warren.
Hello, Mike.
Hi.
I had a couple of questions for you. During all this coverage of the BP oil spill, which is obviously the biggest story in the world right now, a couple of other things that I've heard seem to have kind of gotten buried. They're smaller stories, but have you heard about there was a natural gas explosion in Texas?
Yeah, I did hear about that. I don't think anyone was killed.
No, I think there was injuries.
Yeah, okay.
And also I heard about some kind of leak in Utah, I guess, that they were afraid was going to leach into the Great Salt Lake.
Really? I guess I hadn't heard of that one.
I just heard about it, like, on MSNBC, like, you know, in the regular run of the news, you know?
Right, right.
And I just wondered if you knew more about that.
No, I haven't, although I did hear something. It just floated right by because, like you point out, the biggest story right now is what this catastrophe in the Gulf. But something about, I think it was a natural gas, or I guess natural gas leak in Pennsylvania. I didn't know they were still drilling it. Maybe not. But there's been a series of these, as you point out, a series of these that are clear indications that the technology is just not there. I think one of the leaks was a tanker that overturned or something. I don't know. But the technology just does not seem to be there. And you know, that old saying, a chain is only as strong as its weakest link. You know, we can have 90 operating wells that are doing just fine, and the 91st one brings about an extinction-level event. Do you stand back and say, well, see, drilling for oil is a bad move? I say yes, of course you do. I mean, all you need is one head-on collision in your car at 70 miles an hour, and you're dead. I mean, what do? Drop back, and your survivors will say, well, yeah, but he drove for 40 years without a head-on collision. You know, it doesn't make any sense.
No, it doesn't. it's just, I don't know.
I hope I didn't lose you in that analogy.
No, not at all.
Okay, all right, good.
No, you never lose me, man.
Okay, good. All right, Warren, I got to move on. We're running out of time here. Thank you, sir. I appreciate you checking in. Take care. Rose is calling from somewhere in
Cambridge.
Maine. In Maine? Cambridge?
Yeah, I am.
Oh, yeah? Cambridge, Maine.
No, but I'm in Maine right now, but I'm talking about Cambridge, Massachusetts.
Oh, I got you. Okay. Hi, Rose.
How are you?
Good.
I'm pretty good, too.
Good.
Well, I'm talking about the Gates thing when he got arrested.
The professor.
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Well, at that time, I have a friend who has a TV program, cable.
Uh-huh.
And he has a talk show in Cambridge. And he told me at that time that all the black police officers were getting KKK on their, you know, when he got arrested. Called me up and told me.
Yeah, well, I...
Well, I called the White House.
Right.
I gave my name, address, phone number.
Yeah.
And said, this is who I am, and I come from Cambridge, and blah, blah, blah. But at that time, I was living in Florida. And to make a long story short...
Uh-huh.
I think Obama didn't apologize.
For what?
He did have, well, he was supposed to apologize to say that they were stupid.
I thought he did, more or less. I'm having a hard time figuring out, though, what makes your call pertinent to what we're discussing, Rose, and for the life of me, I don't know. I can't get it. But anyway, I appreciate you checking in. Thanks a lot, Rose. Take care. Okay. We haven't talked about the Henry Louis Gates case for months. I got to ask you, Kathy, why did you put that call through? You thought what?
I thought she must have been referring to a topic that you had brought up recently that I just missed somehow.
Oh, okay. That's right. I just wondered. All right. We have a break here. When we come back, we have a Bridget Speaks for you. We haven't had one of these in months. So stick around. I'm Mike Malloy.
The Mike Malloy Show, all substance, no abuse.
Twenty-five before the hour, as you know, Bridget Wolf is one of the two ethics advisors to this program, Bob Alexander being the other one, and occasionally Bridget will contribute a piece that we share with you, titled Bridget Speaks. And here we are. Mm-hmm. The subject is seeing extinction. How many times can a man turn his head and pretend he just doesn't see? It's almost 50 years since those lyrics were written by a young man from the Minnesota Iron Range. He saw firsthand how they dug gaping pits in the earth to extract iron ore, clear-cutting the forest and turning the ecologically rich home of indigenous people into a wasteland. When asked about his song, Dylan is supposed to have said, "I still say that some of the biggest criminals are those that turn their heads away when they see wrong and know it's wrong." I've been incredibly disappointed in Obama's policies since his inauguration, but I've held on to the belief that this really smart man sees the realities and has the courage not to turn his head. I've torn my hair out and screeched over my disagreements with how he responds to what he sees, but I've not doubted that his eyes are open and he's cognitively capable of grasping the impact of what he sees. After the other night's speech, I am brought to one of three conclusions. Either the man is in a worse bubble than George W. Bush was, or the man we see in front of the camera has been injected with some secret substance that turns people into robots, or the one I'm afraid I'd have to vote for, that he does indeed see, and what he sees is so overwhelming that he has no clue of how to cope with it. If this latter is the case, he has undoubtedly been instructed by his corporate and military masters that he must not convey the horror he sees to the population because it would appropriately cause widespread panic. Once I stopped screaming about the part of his speech where he said, "Pray, you want us to pray? That's our answer?" I started to think about it. I had an image of a POW who has been put in front of the camera to read a script and who tries to get a coded message through, such as, "This is the end of the world as we know it. There's nothing we can do to stop this disaster." If all he can tell us to do is to pray, it must be much worse than most of us have imagined. My fears that this is true are also fed by the fact that BP is still being allowed to control and censor media access. This is undoubtedly the biggest environmental disaster of our time, perhaps an extinction-level event. It has the potential to turn the Gulf into a dead zone for generations. And since the Gulf waters flow into the Atlantic and eventually through all the world's oceans, the toxins being spewed into these waters will eventually affect the ocean ecosystems of the entire planet. Then, of course, there's the lovely prospect of hurricanes picking up this poisonous water and dumping it inland. All of this was evident to anyone with half a brain within the first couple of weeks of this event, as information about the scope of it became available. And what do those in positions of power still do? They turn their heads away when they see wrong and know it's wrong. And why do they do it? First, because money trumps every other consideration, always. And second, because most humans, particularly those of European ancestry, carry a deeply enculturated narcissism that envisions all other life forms as subservient to them. We own land, we own animals, we own trees, rivers, air, space, even the oceans out to a certain number of miles from the shore. When we claim ownership of others, we turn them into commodities. Once they have become commodities, they no longer have any rights. So if I want to replace my deck, the cedar tree has no right to life. If I want cheap meat, it's okay for factory farms to torture animals and destroy waterways with untreated waste. And if I want the way of life that oil has brought me, it's acceptable to risk the whole planet. From the fragile ecosystems of the Arctic to the vital food sources of the Gulf of Mexico. And that doesn't even touch the destruction of the planet as a whole from burning carbon fuels. We are fools, Mike. And the indigenous peoples have been trying to tell us that ever since we found our way across the ocean to begin our ownership and destruction of the lands they called home. Every remaining indigenous culture that I know of relates to the earth as a living being and to everything on her as equal, essential parts of a web of life. That doesn't mean they don't cut down trees if they need them for shelter or kill animals for food and hides, but those actions have usually been done by indigenous peoples with respect for the life that they take, never taking more than they need and always giving back to the environment in some way. The concept of Aryan hegemony, which has dominated the world since at least the days of the British Empire, has never had room for consideration of balance, an understanding of the web of life, or an acknowledgement of the right to survival. of being not of their imperialist bloodlines, of any being not of their imperialist bloodlines. Spurred on by rapacious religions, this destructive need for dominance has destroyed our cultural spirituality and robbed us of our ability to be connected to the larger family of the planet as a whole. For how long have we been raping the earth, fouling our own home? Someone with a better knowledge of history than I may know the answer to that question, but I'll bet that we didn't do it very effectively until the Industrial Revolution, when we learned to create more waste than we could dispose of, when we began extracting non-renewable resources like coal in amounts that were not sustainable. Any animal is smarter than we are. They all know enough not to poop where they eat or sleep. You have read the Hopi prophecies on this show. I first heard of them nearly 30 years ago, sitting at the feet of an amazing Hopi grandmother who had been one of the delegation that took those prophecies to the United Nations. All of the teachings I've heard around these prophecies emphasize that the call to action inherent in them is a return to an honoring of the earth, of living in balance. Perhaps rather than looking to a man, Obama, who by the very nature of his position is a pawn of the powers working to destroy the world, we need to look to the movements of indigenous peoples around the globe who have been trying to tell the proponents of Western civilization for decades how screwed our system is. Perhaps it's time for us to stand with the peoples of Oaxaca, Nigeria, Afghanistan, India, and around the world whose resources are being stolen, whose waterways and farmlands are being poisoned, whose food supply is being destroyed because Monsanto has patented the seeds that these people have grown for generations, and now they are no longer allowed to save them and plant next year. I'm sorry I've gotten off the track here, but the horror of the Gulf is only the largest and currently most visible example of the destruction of our planet. Our corporate overlords have been blowing tops off mountains, damming rivers, and dumping toxic chemicals everywhere they want for decades. We've been busily bashing the planet with tire irons and sticking ice picks into her body. This time we hit an artery, and she's spurting blood. Even now, they try to rationalize it by feeding us crap like, well, it's about the jobs, or we have to keep prices down. I've wondered whether there would ever be a loud enough wake-up call to mobilize the people of this country to bring home the message that you can't breathe the air. If you can't breathe the air, drink the water, eat the food. All the cheap stuff in the world won't help you or your kids survive. Is this that wake-up call? Change is coming, whether we want it to or not, and it was set in motion long before this catastrophe. Perhaps the message is not having Obama step up to lead us through it, is that we are the ones who need to create the response to that change. I don't know what that will look like. Perhaps it will require us to risk our lives, as do the people of so many places in the world every day, to bring an end to the system that otherwise will continue to take our lives and the lives of our children and grandchildren for generations to come. A system that cannot change because it does not include the voices of the other living forces on the planet. If one recognizes Gaia, the planet, as a living being, then there's actually good news in all of this. When any living creature is attacked by parasites, it has to find a way to get rid of them if it wants to survive. Seems to me we humans are doing a pretty good job of helping the Earth bring her worst parasites, us, to extinction. The spirits of the stones, the oldest beings of the planet, tell us that this isn't the first time Gaia has had to abort a failed experiment in the evolution of consciousness. Maybe a couple million years from now, she'll get it right. As always, my best, Bridget. Bridget Speaks, an occasional feature on the program. Bridget Wolfe is the author. If you're a regular listener to the program, you know this. Our house is chock-a-block with some of the structures, the sculptures, the artwork that her husband John has put together. He builds fairy houses. And I'm telling you that every time somebody comes to our house and they see one of these things, they just stop dead in their tracks. Where did you get that? If you want to see the kind of work they do, go to fairywoodland.com, fairywoodland.com, fairywoodland.com. Take a look. You don't have to buy anything if you don't want to. Just take a look at some of the stuff John has done. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy. Before the hour, thanks to the folks who put a lot of good energy into the program. Sharon Gordy, our military affairs correspondent, Bruce Enberg, Kate Petrini, Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf, and, of course, our executive producer and engineer, Kathy Bay. Regarding those other spills, here's one. Salt Lake City is negotiating reimbursement from Chevron for a pipeline oil spill that happened last weekend, and Chevron is promising to pay. Mayor Ralph Becker's spokeswoman says the agreement probably won't involve Chevron setting up an escrow account, however. The Utah Rivers Council called Friday for Chevron to set aside $15 million for damages and cleanup expenses. State water quality officials say the latest samples from 13 locations along Red Butte Creek and Jordan River show no danger to human health or aquatic life. Officials say volatile and toxic compounds have dissipated from the 33,000 gallons of crude oil that spilled into the creek last weekend. Chevron has repeatedly pledged to pay all legitimate claims from the spill and says it has received more than 30 claims so far. And from Bruce, Pennsylvania and New York State are experiencing a natural gas boom thanks to a fracking, F-R-A-C-K-I-N-G, a fracking process patented by Halliburton that uses high-pressure chemicals to fracture or break up shale and release the gas. It is only legal because Cheney made it exempt from all the EPA clean water standards. It causes natural gas to come up people's private wells and explode. And the chemicals being used, proprietary, so no one knows what's in them, poison the well water. The drilling in New York will poison the aquifer that supplies New York City, and some of these chemicals don't filter out with any normal process. Oh, good. Cheney, Dick Cheney, the gift that just keeps on giving, huh? I can't think of one other person in modern history, an American in modern history, I'm sure you can, but I just can't think of one who has caused more death and destruction than Dick Cheney. I mean, he's really the king of the hill, right? Huh. Well, Jason is in Mount Clair, Wisconsin. Hey, Jason.
Yes, I'm in Eau Claire, Wisconsin.
Eau Claire.
I just want to say, I think Jan Brewer, she needs to go through with doing what she wants to do. Let the federal government sue.
No, you're talking about the governor of Arizona.
Absolutely.
Okay.
The president, President Obama, has not gone through with the will of the people on health care, and don't ask, don't tell. And he has not sent equipment nor has he accepted federal aid for the Gulf Coast. Jan Brewer, if you're listening, go through with it. I believe you need to set up double fences, set up one fence that will, that's a warning fence. They need to seal it from South Texas to South California, set up one fence, and then if they decide to go through anyway, and they decide to break the law and trespass,
mm-hmm.
then they need to set up a second fence, which may be controversial, but I believe it'll work, and they need to set up another fence and
electrocute
them.
Is this issue really gotten a hold of you? It sounds like it's got you by the throat and just won't let go.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, these people that are coming in are taking jobs. You know what I'm talking
about?
Wait
a minute. What jobs are they taking, Jason?
Well, lots of jobs. I mean, you know.
No. Well, just tell me one.
Well, okay, for instance, my uncle is a truck driver.
Uh-huh.
He makes deliveries. He used to make deliveries to Americans.
Right.
He's now making deliveries and bringing the stuff to people that don't even speak English.
Well, wait a minute. Who took his job? He's still working.
Okay, but I'm saying these people there. No. Okay. You're a truck driver. You have to make deliveries.
Yeah,
you want to deliver and you want to hand it off to people that you can understand and that they can understand you.
What difference does it make as long as you're being paid? Is your uncle independent or does he work for a company?
Well, he works for a company. But
listen, Jason. Get real, pal. I mean, if this has you so fixated. I don't know what to tell you. Your ass is doomed. Do you know that? You are doomed. If this is what you spend your time thinking about, like the rest of these bagger freaks, I mean, if you're worried about building a fence because, all these, Mexicans come up here and take our jobs, are you kidding me? What jobs do they take? Now, I don't care what your answer is, because you don't have one. Nobody ever has. I'll tell you what. Here's what you can do, Jason. You can come down here to North Georgia, the northern suburbs of Atlanta, where there are chicken rendering plants. And undocumented workers go to work in these chicken rendering plants. And there's a job for you, pal. You'll make $7.50 an hour. You will do nothing all day long except work on an assembly line where you gut chickens and have this stuff spewed all over your body, where you will cut yourself. You will become infected with E. coli, all sorts of diseases that come from chicken feces. These are the jobs. Are you kidding me, Jason? Or I've got a better one for you. Down here in South Georgia, you can come in where there are a lot of undocumented workers who get out here in 105-degree temperature with a heat index of about 126 out in these fields, and you can start picking lettuce, and you can pick peanuts, and you can do stuff like that. Are you out of your goddamn mind? Jason, don't call my program again. Please. I'll see you Monday. Have a great weekend, Kevin, Kenny. I know where you are tonight. You're in Asheville, North Carolina. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy.